in our Democracy Now! Studio back in 2014. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a new report that reveals how Israel is trying to make Gaza unlivable. It's been well documented that Israeli airstrikes account for mass casualties. Now the independent news outlet 972 Magazine has spoken to Israeli soldiers who reveal new details about how they've been systematically using bulldozers and explosives to flatten Gaza from the ground. For example, Gaza's government media office says the Israeli army's destroyed at least 90% of residential neighborhoods in the southern city of Rafah. The 972 report features videos Israeli soldiers shared online, like this one by Avraham Zarviv, who operates a D9 armored bulldozer. His nickname is Flattener of Jabalia, the northern town of Jabalia in Gaza. In this video, he uses his camera to show a flattened landscape in Rafah.
Very good. Givati Brigade, very good. Yes, Rafah. Rafah end, as they say. There will be no more battle in Rafah, because there will be no more Rafah. The nation of Israel lives.
For more, we're joined in Tel Aviv by Meron Rappaport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call and a columnist at 972 Magazine, where his new piece with Oren Ziv is headlined, "Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction." Meron, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what you found and these the access you had, well, because they post them online publicly, to these Israeli soldiers' actual video accounts themselves of what they're doing in Gaza?
I think that Gaza is being destroyed and is already destroyed. This is not really new. We know that. We know that there are very few buildings standing in Rafah. What we have discovered in this investigation, Oren Ziv and I, is that this is a premeditated, that most of it is premeditated, that this is the routine work of soldiers today, or in the last year, or maybe more than a year, since the beginning of 2024, the routine work is to destroy, that this is what they are doing as a routine army service. They go out in the morning, they either accompany bulldozers or a unit that is responsible for explosives. They go, choose buildings and flatten them in a systematic way, and that the aim is quite, it is being said to them, of course, this is not official orders coming from the general headquarters of the Israeli army, but this is very bluntly told, they're being told, and they are themselves very proud of it, that the real aim is to make it impossible for the Palestinians to return to these areas. We have seen that now in these days in Rafah. We are telling that 4% of the building in Rafah are unhurt, undamaged. Only 4%, a city of 200,000 people before the war. So it is a systematic thing. It's not done by, it's not during battle. It's not even a result of airstrike, although, of course, airstrike are responsible for some of the damage. It is a planned thing, and in this, I think it is unprecedented.
And Marin, you open your piece quoting a soldier you identify only as Y, and he describes the demolition methods. And I'm quoting you. You write, quote, "I secured four or five bulldozers from another unit. They demolished 60 houses per day, 6-0. A one or two story house they take down within an hour. A three or four story house takes a bit longer. The official mission was to open a logistical route for maneuvering, but in practice, the bulldozers were simply destroying homes." So this is, to reiterate what you said, this is not in the process of a battle. This is supposedly after, let's say, there's been a battle or conflict, what the Israeli soldiers are doing. So this is total ethnic cleansing of an entire territory. It's effectively what they're doing, isn't it?
Effectively, yes. Of course, this is goes into some gray zone in the international law, what is called domicide, destruction of whole urban areas. It is not officially a crime against humanity. It is certainly against the laws of war to destroy buildings that have nothing to do with military action. But yes, I think there's no doubt that the intention here is ethnic cleansing. The intention here is to make these cities, Rafah, Jabalia, the Netzarim corridor, for the moment, maybe we are seeing something new in the next days, but to make these areas completely impossible, it will be completely impossible for the population to come back because there is nothing left. And it is being said quite openly by the soldiers, by the videos that they air themselves, by soldiers who spoke to us. It is quite clear that this is the intention. Now, the IDF, in its official response to us, said that, no, this is part of operational, there's operational needs that require this demolitions of houses, and this has to do only with operational needs, houses or building where there were they shoot at Israeli soldiers, or there were explosives. Hamas planted explosive in these houses. But what we are seeing is so clear. And again, Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, said that we are destroying house by house so they will have nowhere to come back to. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, said just yesterday that we are not leaving even one stone standing. So it's very clear that the IDF reaction is not based on reality.
And did you discover any moral qualms amongst some of the Israeli soldiers that you interviewed about this practice?
Yes, of course. The soldiers that talked with us didn't feel good or felt very bad with what were they were doing. And this is the reason they talked to us. We talked about 10 soldiers, but they also said that this is such a routine now for Israeli soldiers that they don't really, that most of the soldiers do not pay much attention because this is the routine. This is what they do. There's very little real fighting. And one soldier who spent 3 months in the Netzarim corridor said that he had very, very little real fighting in all these 3 months. And the routine work was to, if there were enough explosive, because sometimes there were not enough explosive, but if there were enough explosive, they would go in the morning, choose between 5-10 houses to demolish, and this is the routine work. So the soldiers really were very used to it, And of course, there were these soldiers that were politically motivated, right-wing soldiers, that really rejoiced in the fact that these Palestinians will have nowhere to return to. But this is not the main, I would say, atmosphere. The atmosphere is, this is the work we are doing, and we just do it. That's what we are sent for.
Meron Rapoport, I wanted to ask you about Microsoft's support for Israel. The Associated Press reports that Microsoft has now acknowledged it sold advanced artificial intelligence and cloud computing services to the Israeli military during the war in Gaza and aided in efforts to locate and rescue Israeli hostages, unquote. Microsoft confirmed this in an unsigned blog post. On Monday, a Microsoft worker who's a member of the No Azure for Apartheid disrupted Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella's keynote address at the company's flagship Build event in Seattle, Washington.
Satya, how about you show him how Microsoft is killing Palestinians? How about you show them how Israeli war crimes are powered by Azure? As a Microsoft worker, I refuse to be complicit in this genocide.
I wanted, Meron, to get your response to these developments and what we know about Microsoft's role, as you've edited reports by 972 on Microsoft, including one in January headlined, "Leaked Documents Expose Deep Ties Between Israeli Army and Microsoft," in a piece that was written by Yuval Abraham, who won the Oscar for being a co-director of the film No Other Land. Meron.
Yes, it seems that this is, of course, there was this report by Yuval, and then there was a previous report quoting mainly Israeli sources, open sources. The head of a unit that is responsible for computing in the Israeli army, that she said that they received essential help to the Israeli war machine from this big three cloud companies, Azure and this is, and we had these documents that we revealed, that Yuval revealed later on. So the relationship is certainly very close, and it does seem that these creates problems for Microsoft internally, and maybe externally and internally. We have to see. We have maybe other reports coming. I think this story is not over.
And Meron Rapoport, you have the United Nations reported in March that from March 2025, since the beginning of 2024, Israel has demolished 463 buildings in the West Bank as part of a military activity, and it's displaced nearly 40,000 Palestinians from several cities in the West Bank. Could you talk about that? And also, you've reported that in Lebanon, Israel used similar demolition operations.
It does seem that this has become really part of the Israeli war, the modus operandi of Israeli army, destruction per se. Not during fighting. We have seen that in Lebanon. We had reports in our investigation in which a soldier was told in advance that what he's going to do is to destroy the Shiites' villages in Lebanon even before he came in. So it didn't have anything, it didn't have direct relation to the fightings. And
Meron,
it seems that this
seconds.
Way of action, it seems that this is way of action is being copied and employed in the West Bank as well.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Meron Rappaport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call and a columnist at Plus 972 magazine. We'll link to your new article, Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction. Meron was speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, Palestinian student Mohsen Madawi graduates from Columbia University 3 weeks after he was released from a Vermont prison after being targeted by the Trump administration. Stay with us.
Ours is just another skin, simply slips away. You can rise above it. It will shed easily. It all will come out fine. I've learned it line by line. One coming wire, one silver thread, all that you desire.
Grateful by Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We end today's show on the campus of Columbia University, where graduation ceremonies are being held this week. On Monday, Palestinian student Mohsen Madawi walked across the stage to receive his GS diploma from the Columbia University School of General Studies. Students erupted in thunderous applause. There was a standing ovation. Mohsen Madawi's path to graduation was not an easy one. In mid-April, he was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he'd been told was his naturalization interview. After the interview, he was taken away by armed, masked, and hooded federal agents. Mohsen moved to Vermont from the occupied West Bank in 2014, where he lived in El Farah, a Palestinian refugee camp. At Columbia University, he was co-president of Columbia's Palestinian Students Union and served as president of Columbia University's Buddhist Association for 2 years. Mohsen is one of several students who've been detained by the Trump administration. His former classmate, Mahmoud Khalil, is still locked up in Louisiana since early March. Mohsen Madawi spent 2 weeks in a Vermont prison before a federal judge in Vermont ordered him released on bail. The judge, Jeffrey Crawford, compared the recent detentions of immigrant student protesters to the Red Scare and the Palmer raids. Crawford ruled Madawi should stay in Vermont but could come to New York for educational purposes. When the government objected to him crossing Vermont lines to come to New York, the judge responded Mohsen Madawi could travel to New York to attend his graduation at Columbia. The judge went on to write, quote, during his time in New York State, Mr. Madawi is permitted to move freely, conduct his daily activities normally, including but not limited to meeting with elected officials, speaking with and being interviewed by members of the press and media, speaking at public events, attending protests, the judge wrote. On Friday, Mohsen appeared in our Democracy Now! Studio for his first live interview since being released from prison. Well, on Monday, I met up with Mohsen again and spoke to him just after he graduated.
My name is Mohsen Madawi, and I just graduated from the School of General Studies.
And how do you feel? Talk about walking up on the stage and your thoughts today.
A mix of feelings, some conflicting feelings. There is a strong sense of joy that I am able to come to this university all the way from a refugee camp to survive the war, to be able to continue holding on hope, to climb the wall, the 30-foot wall, on a constructed ladder and come down by a rope, to make it to America in order to be able to fulfill my uncle's dream, which is education is hope and education is life. So So there is joy in that. There is sadness that my uncle is not here to witness this. And there is sadness that my family, my parents, could not leave the West Bank and come and see this moment. And there is sadness that there are no universities left in Gaza where students can experience such a joy, where hope can be harnessed in universities. And there is joy that also the Trump's administration and this unjust government that tried to keep me in prison. I am on university campus, not in prison. I am in my graduation clothes, not in my prison clothes. And I am celebrating here around the buffet, not having the 20 minutes prepared meal in the prison. So if this is something, this is the hope that I give, the light that I give to the American people, to the good American people who have supported me, to the Vermonters, to the people who fought for justice. It's a hope that democracy is functioning. The justice system that gave me the order to be here is in place, and that our fight for justice, our fight for peace, is a fight for humanity, not only for the Palestinian people.
The judge rebuked the government when they said you couldn't travel over state lines from Vermont, where you were just released from jail, to your graduation. Can you explain what he said?
Judge Crawford has been a person who's holding the scale of justice very firmly. This is what I am fighting for. Justice and peace go hand in hand. This is what I want. And Judge Crawford has granted me to come to New York City to participate in events, in protests. That's my free speech right, First Amendment right in this country. And has granted me the chance to be with the community that I love. And they love me and they love him. You saw how they cheered me up. It doesn't matter what the Trump administration is saying and accusing me of. Columbia University gave the answer, and it comes from the students and from the professors, not from senior administration or from unjust government or unjust laws.
You got a standing ovation when you graduated. Can you talk about how you felt at that point?
I felt honored and humbled. I felt that the inner child who has suffered, and the story of many other children who are suffering and who have suffered, is being seen and acknowledged. And I felt that people stood up for justice, for peace, for human rights, and for international law. This is my message, a message of peace, a message for justice.
What did you think of the valedictory, the valedictorian who referenced the number of people who are not here at graduation?
He's a very brave man. And you have to keep in mind that he comes from an Irish heritage, from resilience, from resistance, from understanding that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Martin Luther King has said. What this university is doing is ridiculous. They are suspending students. They are expelling students just for protesting against the war. What kind of values this university would have if it doesn't allow itself to align with international law and human rights? What worth our degrees? You see the names of philosophers. You see the names of philosophers engraved on buildings in these universities. The most significant ones, Law Library and Butler Library. What is the point if we are studying those philosophers and we are just not bringing those theories into action? Justice, education, interconnectedness, peace, harmony, empathy, forgiveness. This university is a betrayal to all of those values. And what it's doing here is segregating and destroying the democratic system that depends on votes, on sharing voices. And they're telling the students and the professors, you don't matter, but the student's voice is much louder than the money that the university receives.
We're standing next to SIPA, the school you hope to go to in the fall. Do you think you'll be able to? You're in an immigration proceeding now, even though you were going towards naturalization and U.S. citizenship.
Look, I plan on attending SIPA. There are many obstacles. Obstacles with the immigration system, obstacle with the federal justice system, and an obstacle with this university that refused to give me a scholarship. They gave me zero funding, even though they accepted me based on merit. But I tell them that I am coming here to be in the middle of this fire, because I am a peacemaker, because I am a firefighter, and I will come here to study international affairs, focusing on diplomacy and security, and focusing on conflict resolution and peacemaking. This is the story of hope from a refugee camp to Colombia.
From a refugee camp to Colombia, Palestinian student activist Mohsen Madawi speaking after graduating from Columbia University on Monday, just 3 weeks after a federal judge had him released from a Vermont prison. During his interview, Mohsen Madawi referenced the valedictorian address by the Irish student Peter Gorman.
Good morning to the 2025 graduates of the School of General Studies. And congratulations. I can't say how shocked and honored I was to find myself as your valedictorian this year. It begs a question. How does one speak to these people I found myself graduating alongside? The incredible depth and breadth of experience out here. How does one speak in these times? To people whose Columbia experience has been defined by personal and political struggle, by protest and by the university's response to it. We've been challenged not just to learn, but to act. In making that decision, some of us have paid a price. As we graduate, we should remember that this is the first time since 1968 that a Columbia graduating class has been reduced by suspension for political protest. And the first time since Robert Burke in 1936 that a Columbia class has been reduced by expulsion for political protest.
Excerpts of Peter Gorman giving his valedictory address at Columbia University on Monday. After the ceremony, I spoke to Palestinian-American student activist who also just graduated, Mariam Alwan.
I was arrested and suspended for the first encampment. And actually, I was wearing a Columbia shirt when I was arrested, and that was the last time that I wore the Columbia logo, and now I'm wearing it again now that I'm graduating. I honestly did not think that I would graduate, given the level of repression against pro-Palestinian students. So it's a really powerful moment for me, but at the same time, I feel almost guilty because so many are not able to graduate, not only the students who have been disciplined at Columbia, but also the students in Azim who have been killed. And so I wanted to do everything I can to show that I'm thinking of them.
As the reception went on outside the gates of Columbia University, dozens of Columbia professors lined up to hold a vigil around the continued detention of Mahmoud Khalil and other students. This is Columbia Medical School Public Health Biostatistics Professor Melanie Wall.
Melanie Wall, Professor of Biostatistics in the Department of Psychiatry in the Medical Center at Columbia University. The students who've been protesting, and we don't think that the government should, you know, keep this case for anti-Semitism being the excuse for why that our grants are being taken away, and that we have many different things that we're wanting the university to do in terms of self-governance. We are wanting them to not take over the university senate. We're wanting them to allow faculty be part of the choice of the next university president. We want to protect students and scholars from being able to protest. And we want all those things, as well as we want them to fight back against the Trump administration to get our to keep our grants. And so it's not a medical campus.
That was Columbia University biostatistics professor Melanie Wall. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of technology to lead our broadcast digital and IT operations. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.